Hi, everybody. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. And I enjoyed Lou's remarks, and she drank 1 year longer than I did. But I did do a little bit of high school, you know, behind the gym high school drinking, but I don't even count that. So, I've drank for quite a long time, and I've been sober for quite a long time, and you can tell by looking at me, I've been somewhere for a long time. And I love AA now. I just love it. It's the essence of my being, you know. But I'll tell you, when I came into AA, I wasn't all that happy about it. My son came. My son's got 25 years of sobriety. And he came in when he was 21 years old. And some guy came up to him and said, "Oh, isn't it wonderful, you young folks come into AA, and it's just wonderful, you know." And he says, "Yeah, if I live to be 70, he said, it'll be 50 years of these goddamn meetings, you know." And that's kind of the attitude I had when I came in, too. You know. But I went into a bar in Los Angeles when I was 18 years old, and I sat at the bar, and you're supposed to be 21, you know, in California here, and I ordered a drink, and they served me. And immediately I became a man. That's what I wanted to be, a man. And a man can drink, order a drink over a bar without being asked how old he is. And I had arrived. I had become a man. And I never had to worry about another thing as long as I lived, you know. And I felt comfortable in that bar. I just liked everything about that place. And you know, and they had jukebox over in the corner, and I could play those songs over there. And I thought my selection of songs were better than most. And I just felt good in that place. And I went back every opportunity I had from then on. From then on, I drank on a regular basis. And I used to say that I drank myself into alcoholism. You know, I became an I drank for 30 years. And I used to say that I became an alcoholic about 20 years into my drinking, you know. And I've thought that one over, you know. I became an alcoholic when I was 18, and they served me that highball I ordered, and I pursued my every thought. I was under the influence of alcohol for 30 years. I don't mean I was drunk every minute of that time, but I was under the influence. Everything I did, everything I thought about had something to do with booze, you know. And I wouldn't go to anywhere, any party or anything like that, unless I knew there was going to be booze there. And that's the way it was. And I met my wife in a bar. Where else do you meet girls? But I was suspicious of her right away because she wasn't drinking. She was drinking a Coke or something, you know. And I was suspicious of her, and she didn't drink. And we got married, and we moved out little track house out in the east part of Los Angeles area, out in West Covina, and bought a little place there. Nothing down, you know. And the payments were $56 a month. And that included taxes and interest and everything, you know. And I had trouble making those payments. You know, those payments had come due the first of the month, and sometimes I just didn't have the money, because I used my money to drink with. And sometimes I just didn't have it. And I figured, well, I'll just skip it this month, and I'll double up next month. Next month it'd come along and it'd be $112 plus a late charge. And I'd stiff all my other creditors, and somehow I'd make the payments. And we almost lost that place several times. And we finally sold it and moved in with my father for free. You know? and uh, And that's the way we lived. And when we moved out to our house in West Covina, it turned out my wife was pregnant. And, you know, I wanted her to go to work and help out, you know. And here she was pregnant. She already had a little girl by a previous marriage. And now I was going to be stuck with two children. You know, that's the attitude I had, you know. And I didn't start saving for that baby until about 2 weeks before he was born. And I finally had to go to the Pacific Finance Company and borrow the money to pay the hospital and medical expenses for my son's birth. And you know, when I finally got sober in AA, I finally got Pacific Finance paid off. You know, I had that continuous loan going all those years, you know. I'd just about get them paid off and something would happen, something important, you know, would happen, and I'd have to go back and refinance that loan, reconsolidate, you know. By the time I came into AA, I had consolidated that Pacific Finance loan into one big impossible payment. And that's the way I lived, you know. I don't have a very exciting story. You're going to hear much more exciting stories this weekend. And but all I did, you know, is, you know, you hear such exciting things sometimes from the podium. You know, my God, some of the things that some of these people have done, you know. It's just amazing that they ever lived through those things. And, you know, one guy I heard talking, and he's going to a bar. He'd punch everybody out in the bar. And cops would come, and he'd punch the cops out, too. He'd get drug off to jail, get thrown into a cell, and go over to the bunk he wanted, pull the guy out of the bunk, and punch him out. Now, that's tough He-Man drinking, you know. God, I admired that guy, you know. And another guy used to go into a, you know, drive through a tunnel 65 miles an hour and decide to make a U-turn right in the middle of the tunnel. And sometimes he'd come out of a blackout wrapped around a telephone pole about 100 yards off the highway, you know, wondered what happened. You know. And, but the best one of all that I ever heard is some pilot. He came out of a blackout after a 2 week drunk. He came out of a blackout going faster than the speed of sound at 20,000 feet. Now that, you've got to admit, that is class He-Man macho drinking. You know, all I ever did is just sat around and drank. My wife used to kick me out of the house a lot, you know. I'd come home and you know, and I have had a few drinks or something. And she, for some reason, she'd just get angry, you know. And sometimes I'd come home before she did and start dinner even, and she'd still be mad, and she'd kick me out of the house. And I had no self-worth back in those days at all, and you know. And she said, leave. What I should have said is, wait a minute, I'm the guy that's working here. I'm making the payments, you know. You can't kick me out of my own house. That's what I should have said. Instead, I just left, you know. I didn't move very far from home, just down the street. And then I'd work my way back in the house. And I was in and out, back and forth. She divorced me 3 times. And the last time she divorced me, I'd had enough. I says, you want a divorce, you've got it. You know. I said, I'm sick of these games we're playing. And you can have the house, you can have the furniture, you can have everything. All I want is my stack of old 78 records. You know. They're collector items, and I want those. And that's it. You can have everything else. And I moved to a little shack, a little garage, actually, that they had made living quarters in Hermosa Beach. And it was a half a block from the water. The landlady said, we're just a half a block from the water. And I said, oh, man, that's great. And And I figure, you know, I'm going to get up every morning and run 5 miles along the ocean edge. You know. And then I'll plunge into the water and I'll ride some waves in, you know, body surf some waves in, and I'll really feel great. You know. And as far as I know, the water was down there. I really never got around to checking it out, you know. I was going to. You know. I just didn't get around to it, you know. I only lived there 5 years. And it turns out, you know, I used to wonder, why is she divorcing me? Why does she kick me out all the time? You know, I'm not doing anything. And it turns out, after I got sober, that was the reason. I never did anything. You know, I finally, I wound up in this little shack. It was an old little garage that they had made some living quarters. And I figured, great, now I can start my life over again. And I won't have anybody nagging at me. And I'll pay my child support and all that stuff, you know. But I'm on my own now. And I probably won't drink as much as I did. And it turns out that I drank more. In fact, my daily routine back then was to wake up at 10 o'clock. I'm already an hour late to work. Oh, man, I'd throw my clothes on, get in that car, weave in and out of traffic. I had to get there. You see, I should have worked yesterday. I left all those papers all over my desk, and I had papers in my desk drawer. Some of them were months old. They were too old to turn in. You know, if I turned them in, the boss would want to know why I held them so long, and he'd fire me, you know. And if I didn't turn them in, I was going to be fired. And I knew today's the day. This is it, you know. I drank my wife away, my kids away, my home away. I drank everything away. And all I've got left, the last bit of respectability I have, is my job. And now that's going to go, too. And I'm going to wind up on the street. And I was really, you know, afraid that when I got there, there'd be a note on the desk, you know, see the boss. And I'd get to work and check my desk out. Everything seemed to be the same. And I'd go to the coffee room, get a cup of coffee, and come back to my desk and sit there, drink coffee, and make excuses to my customers and try to look interested. And I was waiting for a respectable time to go to lunch. You know, and finally about 11:30, I decided to go to lunch. And I would go to lunch at the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And they sold martinis over there. And during the lunch hour, they sold martinis for $1. Double for $1. The regular ones were 75 cents. But during the lunch break time, they sold double martini for $1. I don't know if any of you've been in a nice restaurant recently, but I always check and see how much. I'm sober 29 years. I always check. Thank you. And I always check how much martinis are whenever I'm in a nice restaurant. And, you know, geez, you know, they're up to about $4.50 in Charlotte, you know. And I think, God, I couldn't drink anymore. I just don't have enough money, that's all. And that's motivation, you know, right there. But they serve these martinis, and I like martinis. And so I'd go over there, and I'd order. And I'd say to myself, you know, you're going to have two anyhow. So you might as well order the dollar one. You'll save 50 cents. God knows you need the money bad. And so I'd order the dollar one, and I'd get to sipping on it and kind of check my drink against the guy sitting next to me, and he'd have a 75 center, and I'd kind of check his drink, and I'd say to myself, this isn't really a double. You know, it's a little bigger than the 75 center, that's all. You know, if it were really a double, they'd be charging more money for it. Who the hell do they think they're kidding? So I better have another one. And then I'd 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 call the office and say, I forgot to tell you I'm going to make a lot of calls this afternoon. Take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd head towards the beach, and I'd get home about 2:30 in the afternoon. And I'm kind of a neat drunk. I'd hang up my clothes real carefully so the creases fall properly, you know. I'd hang up my tie and shirt and my shoe and take my shoes off and put them away and put my pajamas on. And it'd be like 2:30 in the afternoon. And I'd sit there on the edge of the bed and I'd untap that cheap, on the way home, I would stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find, and I'd untap that cheap vodka, you know, and I'd take a big, big jolt out of it, you know, several swallows, and I'd say to myself, you know, well, you've done it again today. You know, this cannot continue. You're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why the hell don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and do nothing, you know. And I'd put one of those old records on the turntable. You know, something like Billy Eckstein singing, Who Can I Turn To? And then I'd go into my fantasy about starting tomorrow. It's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork for a couple hours. When that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, a whole new life is going to open up for me. Starting tomorrow, I'm going to settle down and get back into business, you know. And I'm going to spend every waking moment starting tomorrow earning money. And I'm in sales. I can work any hours I want to. You know, I can work Saturday and Sunday. And starting tomorrow, I'm going to work 365 days in a row. And starting tomorrow, I'm going to quit drinking. And I'm going to spend 1 year out of my life playing catch-up. And I'm going to get, I can't do anything about that marriage, but at least I can get squared away financially. And at the end of a year, you know, if I do what I say, you know, I'm gonna be out of debt, and I'll have my own brand new car paid for, and I tended to project a little bit. I could just see myself at the end of that year, you know, and I'd be salesman of the year, you know, and I could just see it. And I could, you know, and I just started celebrating a job well done right then and there. Then I'd play some upbeat music, and things were good. Things were going to get better. Things were going to be okay from now on. And then I'd check the clock. It would be 10:45. Jesus, where is this day gone? I can't believe it. Can't be that. 10:55, it can't be that late. And so I'd call the operator and check. 10:55. And then I'd realize I was almost out of booze. And so the liquor store was 2 blocks away. So I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas and I'd run 2 blocks to the liquor store. That's when I first started jogging about that time. I'd get there just as they were closing the door. A bottle of Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands right around where I lived. I didn't want anybody to think I was cheap there in the neighborhood. Then I'd come back and maybe you ought to not work for 2 years in a row. You know, at the end of 2 years, you'll have so much money, that you'll be able to take a year off. And you can buy a boat. You can sail all over the world in that boat. And I'm here to tell you folks that I have been all over the world. I have sailed all over the world in my fantasy, sitting on the edge of my bed. And I'd start rehearsing the speech I was going to give because I knew I was going to be salesman of the year. And somewhere in there, I'd pass out. And I'd wake up, and it'd be 10 o'clock. And I'd throw my clothes on and get in that car and weave in and out of traffic and get there. I had to get there. I should have worked yesterday. Get there and shuffle papers and try to look interested and make excuses to my customers. They wanted to know where their stuff was, you know. It was in my bottom desk drawer. That's where it was. And I said, you haven't got that yet? I said, I'll personally, you know, the class of help we have to hire nowadays, you know, they don't know the meaning of the word service. I'll personally take care of this today. And if you don't hear from me by, you know, early next week, if you don't get it in the mail, call me and we'll get this thing straightened out. Yeah. And I do that about 10 times, you know. And I'm one of the originators of the computer excuse. I'm sure you've all heard the computer excuse. You know, you call them up and you want to check your bill or something. Well, our computer's down. It's been down for the last 4 days. I used to use that excuse, you know. I used to tell these guys that, you know, our computer's been down for the last 5 days. And as soon as it gets working, I'll get a printout and we'll take care of this, you know. I used that excuse before we even had a computer in our office. And then I'd go next door to the bar and have a dollar, make my big decision of the day, whether to have a dollar one or the 75 center. And then I'd have another one. And I'd go home about 2 or 2:30 and stop and buy the cheap bottle of vodka and get home and change into my pajamas and sit on the edge of the bed and berate myself, you know, that, you know, done it again today. This cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why the hell don't you do something about it? You just sit around and talk about stuff you never take any action on anymore. And then I'd put one of those old records on the turntable. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, Who Can I Turn To? You know? And then I'd go into my fantasy, you know, about starting tomorrow. You know, I didn't do that once or twice. I did that hundreds of times. You know, towards the end of the month, the boss would want to know. He said, are you in sales here? And I'd say, yeah, I'm in sales. Well, how about making a sale? I'd say, don't worry about a thing. I'm a fast finisher. And I was, because he'd scare me, and I didn't want to lose my job. And I really would work around the clock. And I always made my quota. And at the end of the year, if you make your quota, they give you a big plaque with your name on it. You know, a big plaque. Hank Johnson, outstanding production, you know. And type of representative we want to represent this company and all that stuff, you know. For 8 drunken years in a row, I won a plaque every single year. And then I got sober. And then I didn't win a plaque for 8 years. You know, I had the misguided notion that if I quit drinking, I could double my sales. And what happened to me, I don't know if it happened to other people. I've seen it happen to a few. You know, I had about 2 years of sobriety, and I got so spiritual that I damn near sailed off into the blue. That happens to some of us, and various lengths of sobriety. But I got so spiritual, I figured I didn't really have to work. You know, I figured they were lucky that I showed up on time. Yeah. That I ought to get a raise just for showing up on time. They don't give you a raise for showing up on time. They give you a raise based on what you do. That's just like in AA, you know. Guys can talk a good talk and all that, you know. But that's not what you're judged on here in AA. Judge on your actions. Action is the magic word around here. And it's that way out there, too. And I walked in that office. I had almost 2 years of sobriety. And I kind of floated in. I was so spiritual there. And I was a note, see the boss. And I went in and see the boss, and he fired me. I said, well, you can't fire me. You know? I've got an outstanding record with it, sales record with this company. He said, not lately, you don't. And I said, well, I'm not going to let you fire me before I talk to the regional manager. And I went to the regional manager, and I used to say I took my fifth step with him. But what I really did is it's cried and whined to him. And I said, you know what they want to do down there at the branch office? They want to fire me, with my outstanding sales record. You know, what they don't understand is that about 2 years ago, I completely changed my life. I quit drinking. And I'm trying to make it again with my wife and the kids and trying to start over again. And I'm trying to pay my bills and become a citizen in the community again. And now this guy wants to fire me. He don't know that I've quit drinking. And he says, geez, Hank, I had no idea you had a problem with alcohol. He says, I sure hope you wish you luck, you know. He says, and I hope you and your wife make it. And he says, but I can't do anything about if they want that. If they don't want you to work down there in that branch office, I can't tell them that you have to work there. He says, but you claim to be a salesman. He says, we've got 80 offices. Why don't you go around and try to get a job at one of those offices, and I'll put you on paid leave of absence for 30 days. So that's what happened. I transferred to another office, and I'm very grateful that I didn't get fired. And I'm grateful that I was able to work there, that company, for 28 years. I retired in 1986, and they've been paying me big bucks ever since. You know? And I'm going to live to be 110 years old. I'm going to get every dime that company's got. But what happened, my sponsor got to me, you know, he says, Hank, you don't seem to understand what this program's all about. He says, you know, some people just get so spiritual, they just get so heavenly that they just become of no earthly good to anybody. And that's what's happened to you. And he said, I suggest that you start to work, start helping people, and so on. So, you know, get into action. And that's what I've tried to do ever since. And I finally started winning plaques again, and made me nervous. I was able to retire from that company. But before all that, you know, my son got drunk when he was like 16, went to a party, and he came home drunk, and the kids brought him home, and he fell out of the car, you know, he was really plastered, and my wife called me up and said, come and get your drunken son, he's just like you are. And I should have said, wait a minute, you know, you won him in the divorce settlement, you know. Yeah, that's what I should have said, you know. You want him in the divorce settlement, and now that you're having some problems with him, now you want me to take him, you know. And you know, he used to come and visit me once in a while, stay over. You know, he hated it. He didn't want to come down and spend any time with me, and I didn't want him to come down, you know. Made me nervous, you know. But I'd get a few drinks in me, and I don't know about you people, but when I start drinking, and I love everybody. Yeah. Some guys are fighters. You know, I'm a lover. I just love everybody. And whoever I'm with, I love them the most. You know. And it's my son that'd be there, and he was 16, you know. And I just used to tell him how much I loved him, you know. You know, even though your mother and I are divorced, you know, that doesn't mean that we don't love you. You know, I love you very much. I try to kiss him, and I'd have, you know, I could just see that face that he had, you know, disgust, you know, and drooling, you know, drooling all over him and all that. And he could hardly wait to go home. And I'd wake up the next morning, it'd be Saturday, I'd have him Friday night, and supposed to bring him back on Sunday, and I'd say, come on, get in the car. And I just couldn't even look at him. I was so embarrassed. You know, I can't tell my son I love him when I'm sober. I have to get drunk to tell him. And so I would just drive him up to the house and dump him off. And feel lousy about the whole situation. So anyhow, she told me to come and get him, and I, you know, I should have balked at that, but you know, I went up and got him, and he didn't want to come and live with me, and I didn't want him to come and live with me, but she said, so we had to do it, right? So he came and lived with me, and I kind of cut down on my drinking for a while, a little bit there. And I did the cooking, and he did the cleaning, and I was making him do his homework at night. And I really, you know, I'm good at responsibility. You know, as long as it's your responsibility, I can tell you exactly what you're supposed to be doing at any minute of the day. And so I had him really jumping through the hoops, and his grades improved and everything else, you know. And so things were going so good that, but my ex-wife moved in with me too, you know. And we converted the garage part of that garage house into a bedroom, threw an old carpet down on the cement floor, and put a bed out there in an old, kind of an open garage. It had a garage door, but that's the way we lived. You know. And little did I know that during that 2 or 3 year period that we were divorced, she had started drinking after all those years. And, you know, she became an alcoholic from first drink. In fact, she knew she was an alcoholic before she ever drank, because her father was an alcoholic, and they had a similar personality. And she was a full-blown alcoholic right away. And, you know, some people can get by with it. I didn't think I was an alcoholic till I was about 20 years into my drinking. And that's because I got away with it for a long, long time. I never got in any trouble with my booze. And the last 10 years of my drinking were rough. But she got in trouble immediately. You know, some people, the first time they get drunk, they have an accident, and they thrown out in the jail, and, you know, they just in all kinds of trouble immediately. I got by with mine for 20 years. So she moved in, and she said, I won't even fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, you know, I'll join you. So I thought, you know, I had no idea. And so, you know, I'd go to work and come home about 2 o'clock and sit in my pajamas and think about starting tomorrow. It's all going to be different. Drink out of that cheap bottle of vodka and sit there and play phonograph records. And my son would come home. It would be about 2:30 in the afternoon. And I'd say to him, you know, I don't know who you think you're kidding. School doesn't even get out till 3. And you're home here at 2:30. You've ditched school. And I'd stand there in my pajamas with a bottle of vodka in my hand. And I'd ask him, you know, how the hell do you expect to amount to anything? You know, If you don't apply yourself in this world, my son, you haven't got a chance. And I'm really concerned. I'm really worried about you. And he'd look at me funny. He always had four or five guys with him, and they all looked at me funny. And then my wife would come home about 5 o'clock, and we'd have our first drink of the day together. My 20th and her first, you know. As we were finishing that first drink, I'd start cozying up to her, because I'm a lover when I drink. She'd start getting standoffish. And by the time she finished her first drink, all hell would break loose. And she was not a fun person to be around when she drank. She was a mean drunk. And she did stuff like throw the Christmas tree, lights and all, out the back door. All in a blackout. And one night I told her, I'm going to my brother's house. I said, this is ridiculous. You know, you shouldn't. A woman like you, person like you, shouldn't drink. You know. Some people just can't drink. You're one of them. You know? And I said, I'm going to my brother's house and stay all night with him. And when I get back tomorrow morning, I expect you to be out of here. That's more time than you ever gave me. And so while I was gone, she decided to commit suicide. Before she did, she went into the closet where my clothes were hanging and just took a knife and slashed every stitch of clothes I owned and cut the pant legs off my pants and my shirts and ties and even stabbed my damn shoes. And just went out in the living room and broke all the lamps and all my collector item records and it just destroyed that little place we lived in. And then she turned the gas on the kitchen oven and went to bed. She woke up the next morning, you know. That old place we lived in was, you know, the wind used to whistle through those boards. You could have turned the gas on 10 ovens and never smelled it. So she survived, you know. And she looked around, and our son had been staying with someone else that night, too. And I came home about 9 o'clock in the morning. When she woke up, she looked around, and she saw all this stuff. And she knew she had done it, you know. The place was just in shambles, like a bomb went off in there, you know. And she couldn't remember doing it, but she knew she had done it. And it scared her. I had been to a doctor, and this doctor told me I ought to quit drinking and go to AA. She had been with me and heard what the doctor said. I got home there, and it was just, you know, that was our bottom, you know. Things had just got so bad. When we first got married, we had wonderful plans, you know. We were going to have the house and the white picket fence and all that stuff, you know, that everybody dreams of. We're going to be, you know, in a nice neighborhood and a nice job and all that stuff, you know. And all was all going to happen, you know. And we were going to live the good life. And all we had managed to do is sit around and drink every bit of goodness out of our lives. And from then on, nothing was good. From then on, everything was bad. And the booze wasn't doing its job like it had before. And it was just bad news. She went back to that doctor and asked him if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he had told us that the reason he recommended that I go to AA is that his wife is an alcoholic. And they had sent her to hospitals and sanitariums and stuff, and she'd do her 30 days in the hospital and come out, and she hadn't had a drink, you know, for 30 days, and within days she was drinking again. And he said nothing worked for her, and the only thing I can tell you is she's sober right now for 7 months. She goes to AA, and that's what you ought to do. And
So, anyhow, I didn't go. And so, it's a long, drawn-out story. And so, she went back and asked him, and he says, why don't you go to some meetings with my wife? She'd be happy to take her and take you. And that's what happened. That's why I'm standing here tonight, because she went to AA. And I had been to a meeting about 2 years prior to that. And it was a meeting in California. They give chips a little different than they do down south. And I don't know how they give them here, but that meeting I went to, they gave chips at the beginning of the meeting. And they said, has anyone just finished their 30 days in sobriety? If so, come up and get your chip and say a few words. And here comes this guy up, you know, he's all proud. My name's Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. And I know this is a spiritual program. I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings. And I just love everybody, you know. Just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my employer, and he's made me general manager down at the plant. It's just a wonderful, glorious life here. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. And I think, oh, man, it just, you know, made my flesh crawl, you know. Just, what is, where, how did I get here, in here, anyhow? Yeah. And is there anyone else finished their first 30 days? And here comes this little lady running up and getting her chip. And my name's Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm really proud to get this chip. And I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back. And I just love everybody. You know. And a short time ago, when my children looked my way, they had a look of fear in their eyes. Now when our eyes meet, there's a look of respect. And I've noticed lately that my husband is looking at me with renewed interest. And it's just a wonderful, glorious way of life. My children were all failing in school. And now we're getting letters from all the major universities throughout the United States offering free scholarships. And I just can't begin to tell you how wonderful it is to be sober. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you. And I wasn't able to attend the whole meeting that night. I needed a drink. And I went and got one, I'll tell you. And so, you know, that was my experience in AA. And she started going to meetings, and be a good guy, I'd go to the meetings with her. And I sat in these rooms for almost a year, denying that I was an alcoholic. People would ask me, you an alcoholic? No, I'm a visitor. You know, she's one, you know. Work on her, you know. And so finally I told her, I said, I've gone to my last meeting. I can't stand these meetings, you know. And I said, I've gone to my last one. And I said, but I'm going to quit drinking. I realize I'm an alcoholic. I've learned that here. You know? And so I quit drinking. And I didn't go to meetings. And it was a little bit before Thanksgiving. And I didn't drink. Through the holiday season, through the drinking as part of the year, I didn't drink. And the Saturday night after Christmas, I was sitting there, and she had gone off to a meeting, and I was sitting there, and I realized, you know, it's been over 40 days, and you haven't had a drink. And you haven't had a drink through the drinking as part of the year, through the holiday season. Everywhere you go, they push a drink your way, and you didn't drink. So you must not really be an alcoholic after all. So I went to the liquor store and I bought a half a pint of vodka. And I no sooner got it back to the place, I drank it practically straight down. What the hell did I buy a half pint for? And I went and got a fifth, and went and got another fifth. Drank all Saturday night, all day Sunday. I closed the bar up at 2 a.m. And I woke up the next morning. It was 10 o'clock, and I'm already an hour late to work. And I went to the job, you know, and I got there, and I felt terrible. I was sick. And I poured all that alcohol into my system all at once, and I was really sick. So I went over to the bar a little early that day. And I ordered a Bloody Mary, because that's what you order when you're sick. And it's not even any kind of a social drink at all. It's medicine. And I ordered a glass of medicine. And I drank that Bloody Mary straight down. I just, God, and I, whew, put the fire out. You know. I said, make another one. And I looked down. I'd spilled half of it all over my tie. And so I went to the restroom and tried to clean the tomato juice off my tie. And I came back to the bar, and he said, did you want another Bloody Mary or did you want a martini? And I said, I'll just skip it. And I went over to the coffee shop section of that bar. I had a sandwich and a glass of milk, and I haven't had a drink since. You know, it's so funny how we take that last drink. It's eerie almost. My sponsor, he got kicked out of the midnight mission, and he had to walk 72 blocks to the AA club, and that he had gotten kicked out of because he stole money off the counter, and they let him in, and they said, you know, he told him, you know, I'm sick. He said, oh, go in and lay down, and go in the other room and lay down. And he hadn't had a drink for 40 years, you know. And we never know when we're going to quit drinking. And so I quit. And we were both sober. And everything wasn't smooth, you know. And I told you I got fired after 2 years and all that stuff. And it was tough. But we managed to get by, and we bought a beautiful home. We bought a condo in San Fernando Valley, and then we bought a beautiful home up on the desert in north of Los Angeles in the high desert, and we were going to retire up there, and we were going to have both places for a while, and we were doing good, you know, and she went to the doctor. And the doctor told her she had cancer, lung cancer, and gave her 90 days to live. And she came to my office and told me. And I don't take that kind of news very well. I'm immature, you know. And I took that news badly. And I thought to myself, well, that just shows you, you know, you work your ass off and try to get squared away, and what good is it, you know, she's going to be sick now, but I went to my meeting that night, you know, because I've been trained. I don't care how you feel. You feel good, you go to your meeting. You feel bad, you go to your meeting. And I went to my meeting that night, and it was just average meeting, you know, and discussion groups that night, but at the custom at that meeting, and a lot of meetings in Southern California, I don't know if they do it up here or not, but they read on page 164 on the vision for you, they read at the end of the meeting, and they said, you know, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. You know, ask in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who's still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. And I heard that. I've heard that hundreds of times. I've read it hundreds of times. But it had a big impact on me that night. And I walked out of the meeting and I said, yeah, our house is in order.
I had long since paid all those bills. You know, I had long since squared my life away. And everything that needed to be said between her and I had long been said. And we were talking about it at dinner. And, you know, we were current in our affairs. You know, we were caught up. Sometimes people ask me, what have you got from AA? You know, well, besides your sobriety, of course. What have you really got? I got caught up. I was always coming from behind. You know, I couldn't do anything because I had all this other stuff I had to do before I could do the... Yeah. And so when I walked out of that meeting, I knew I was going to be some help to her. And I was. And I did. And she lasted 5 years. And she died. And she died right after her 16th AA birthday. We were both sober at the same time. I had 3 days on her. Because she forgot the part about the pills. Somebody says, you know, Hank, I don't want to insult you or anything, but your wife seems to be doing a lot better in AA than you are. And it turns out, well, the reason is she's taking pills, you know. She wasn't feeling any pain, you know. But where I come from, they don't want you to take any of those non-habit-forming pills or smoke any of that non-habit-forming cigarettes. And they don't want you to do any of that stuff. They want you to face life full on. And they expect you to do that. They expect you to work through all these problems, you know. And even if you have fear, you work through them. Work through the fear. And then you feel good. Then you feel spiritual. And I had a hard time learning that. But anyhow, she lived for 5 years, and she died a few days after her 16th birthday. And I dangled a numeral 16 on a gold chain in front of her. You know, she was out of it. You know, she had been out of it for about 3 months. But I like to think that her eyes kind of lit up when I did that with the chain on the numeral 16. And so then she died. Now, what am I going to do now? You know, here it is again. You know, she's gone. And so what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And I'm not going to sit here up in the desert all by myself, you know. And so I started going back to the group in Los Angeles that I'd gone to before, the Pacific group. And I started going back there. And I got pulled back into AA big time, you know. Both the men and the women of AA just pulled me back into action, man. You know, I'd been dealing with death so long that they just pulled me back in the world of the living. But, you know, I thought about it. It was a shame that she had to pass away. She was too young. You know, I smoked 20 years longer than she did. And she's the one that caught lung cancer, you know. And you try to figure it out, what God's will is. You know, I don't think that's God's will. I just think she smokes too many cigarettes. I don't know. I just don't think God does that to people. Yeah. And you go crazy trying to figure out what I do. I go crazy trying to think about what God's will is for me. You know. And so I've just learned to accept things as they come. And there's a good friend of mine, Keith C., that he wrote a little prayer, you know, and he says that he has, dear God, let me accept the seemingly good as well as the seemingly bad as necessary for my growth in AA. And that's kind of what I said too. And about 6 months went by, and I started looking at the ladies again, you know. And I'd go home and I'd say, you know, you ought to call that gal at the meeting, you know. And then, you know, and I'd talk to him. I said, well, if you call,
call her, you know, she's not going to want it. What makes you think she wants to go out with you, you know? And, well, you know, I'd say to myself, well, why don't you call her and find out, you know? And so I'd call. You want to go out Saturday night? Sure. Oh, jeez. Now what am I going to do? And, you know, I don't know anything about relationships. I've been married all my life. And so, you know, it's all those feelings came back to me when I was 17 and 18 years old. All those feelings of inadequacy, clumsiness, bashfulness, all those feelings. And I remembered why I drank in the first place. And I said to my mom, well, I'm not going to drink this time. And so I went to Charlotte in 1989, I guess it was, and talked at a little convention there. And I met a lady there. And I had met her about 10 years before that in Wisconsin, I talked. And her, a guy I got sober with and moved back to Wisconsin and started a little meeting. Guy I got sober with, we had the same sponsor, and he went back and started this meeting that she joined, and so we knew a lot of people in common. We had a lot. I said, the next time I'm in Charlotte, you know, or anywhere near here, I'll call you. Maybe we can go out to dinner. She said, that'd be fine. And so I was kind of close one time, about 1,200 miles away. So I called her. I called her and we went out to dinner and one thing led to another, and to make a long story short, you know, I now live in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we've been married for about 7 years now. And she's got 17 years in AA. And so, and we have an AA household, and we sponsor a lot of people in Charlotte. And we brought California-style AA to Charlotte. And I'm not putting AA down in Charlotte. A lot of great people there. But they don't clap for anything. You know, we're now going to have Joe read portion of chapter 5. Nobody does a thing. He just sits there on their hands, you know. And then he gets finished and he sits down. Nobody, you know. It was hard for me to get used to that. So we started a clapping meeting. And we give cakes. They don't give cakes. They give chips. And give a blue chip for sobriety, you know. I'm used to cakes, you know, with candles on. And so we give cakes. And our meeting has grown. And we get, you know, 80-100 people there every Thursday night. And we're doing fine. And we sponsor a lot of people. And that phone's jingling off the hook. And she still works. And we're doing good. And when my wife died, you know, I had not had a real good relationship with my kids when I first stopped drinking, you know. And so after she died, I went to both my kids and I said to them, I don't know what you expect, what your expectations of a father should be. But if you can tell me what you expect, I'll just try my damnedest to live up to your expectations. And I said it to both of them. And my son, he said, Dad, I just wish you'd come by once more often and hug your grandchildren. And I was talking to somebody about that. And he said, yeah, he wants you to hug his grandchildren, but he wants you to hug him. You know, because I didn't do that when he was growing up. So now whenever I see him, I'll give him a big hug, and I tell him I love him. And my daughter, too. And But she's not an alcoholic, and she don't understand, you know. And so I got a good life, you know. It's good. It's a great life. I just can't begin to tell you all the good things. My wife and I, my current wife, and I got to go to London, got to go to Paris, and we just have done some wonderful things together, and it's been great. And so about the only thing I can say in conclusion here is that, you know, there was a gal at talk at a meeting I went to, and she said her little son at Christmas time, he was about 4 years old, and he was opening up Christmas presents, and he'd open up 20 gifts, you know. And then he started crying. And his mother says, What's wrong? And her son, little son, said, I didn't get what I always wanted. And she said, well, what is it that you always wanted? He said, I don't know. And boy, I identify with that. You know? And I went to AA for damn near a year. And every meeting I went to, there were good folks trying to give me the gift of sobriety. And I took it. I thought they were nagging me, you know. And I didn't appreciate it. And I didn't take the gift of sobriety. I finally got sober. But and it turns out, you know, that the gift of sobriety is my most precious possession. And everything good that's happened to me in the last 29 years have stemmed from that gift. And it's the rock of my being. It's the foundation of my being, sobriety. I love being sober. And I don't mean kind of sober where you just swear off. You know, I'm talking about the kind of sobriety we have here in AA, with the steps and the tradition. And I'm so grateful that I'm sober, and I love AA now. You know? And so about all I can say to you folks is, it turns out that this is a spiritual program, you know. And I know that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that turn me on and keep me coming back. Thank you.